This is Inside Douglas County on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN. It's our daily in-depth look at people and issues that are shaping the local area. Inside Douglas County is presented by Concrete Builder Supply. Now, Inside Douglas County on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, afternoon. Thanks for being here. We thought we would do a program a little bit on the lighter side today and check in on one of our big local industries that attracts a lot of attention, and that is wine. Dyson DeBar from Hillcrest Vineyards. Paul O'Brien Winery, is it Pozzuolina?
Pozzuolina, that's good.
Okay.
Perfect. Yeah.
I believe me, if you saw how I spelled it, it's not at all accurate, but it was to help me get it correct. And you've been involved in a lot of things around here for years with wine. Overall, what did the year in wine feel like as a grower of grapes?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we came here to do wine from Napa Valley in 2001 and took over Hillcrest in that. This is, I'm trying to think back, 82. This is my 40th year, 40th vintage, which I'm almost embarrassed to say that. Wow. In agriculture, which wine is really about agriculture, the great wine regions of the world are not great because somebody famous owns a winery or it's a fancy building and that. It's really about what nature delivers. And wine, of course, is a food product. So we see, people talk about Walla Walla onions or apricots from a certain area or apples from an area. There's something magic about that nature that tends to bring out a beautiful but a very unique fingerprint. And that's where we build wineries. So that's what actually drew us here. No two vintages are the same. This year, usually we walk down kind of a band and, one vintage will be a little warmer than another. One will be a little bit cooler. This, as we all know, especially those of you that like to garden, it was so, so extreme and unusual. We started off with such a cool, wet spring that usually, so when you grow things like tomatoes, there's early season, mid-season, late season varieties. We see them ripen accordingly. So same thing is true with grapes. And usually that window, if you look at an industry like Umpqua Valley or Napa Valley, people grow a range of varieties. So something like Sauvignon Blanc that's early, Pinot Noir that's early, is followed by Syrah, Merlot, which are mid-season, and then Cabernet, Zinfandel, Petit Syrah are late season. That window is usually about 6 weeks. And this year we actually had it with that really cool, my daughter's in-laws, she married an Italian beer maker who's here. They were here for 6 weeks in the spring, and it rained pretty much every day. And it took those early varieties like Pinot Noir and stacked them up against Cabernet Sauvignon. So literally, we lost, at one point, I figured we were about 5 weeks behind in the growing season. So generally speaking, it does for the entire region. Depending upon sites and a little bit warmer side or cooler side, it kind of played with that number a little bit. But 5 weeks behind and taking everything and kind of stacking it together is pretty unheard of. It was pretty extreme and rare. We ended up, finishing our harvest in terms of like putting wine to barrel here just 2 days ago, and the overwhelming majority of our harvest was October 20th through 27th. We started picking out grapes earlier than that for delivery to downtown, and that. But for Hillcrest, we started on the 20th and finished on the 27th. So. Extremely late vintage, but super, super compact. And that plays into certain things, certain varieties. Other varieties, it's much more challenging. So this is a year, you've got to be judicious. You couldn't be greedy in terms of having a lot of fruit on the plant, because if you did take a variety and push it way back into a cooler end, part of the growing season, which is the very tail end, you might not have the ripeness that you want. Or you might have a form of ripeness like sugar, but maybe not the flavor or the maturity of tannins that you want in a red wine and that. So it's a super, super interesting vintage. As in all vintages, there are certain crazy standouts. And so there are certain things we look forward to. Other things will need some work. And then, quality producers, we do things, as Kyle, very, very old school. And one of the traditions of the great wineries of Europe is that they typically bring in about maybe a third to half of more wine than they'll actually bottle. Ferment it, and then post-fermentation basically do some type of a cut and bottle a percentage of that. And that's something that's not really done so much today. I usually cull out, as I say, about 50% of what we produce, even in really good vintages. And that's one of the tricks to being a great producer is consistently having very high quality and not just bottling everything that you grew or you purchased.
That's got to be hard to do on one level because, you want to be essentially intellectually honest to the type of product that you're trying to produce,
But then somebody over in accounting says, you know, if you did this a little differently, you'd make more money.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's that. And even beyond that, you know, you don't know what you don't know. We have a lot of new folks globally in the wine business, too, that what is fine wine? So, you know, the economics is important to everyone. But it's one of the things that's really changed. You know, I mentioned I've been in the business for 40 years. When I first got in the wine business, if you looked at a publication like the Wine Spectator, it was actually really written about the vineyard management, where their vineyards are located, the winemaker style thereafter. And the winemakers drove everything that happened inside of a winery, and support were like sales and marketing, finance, and that. Today, that's totally changed. In small wineries and big wineries alike, the dollar drives everything. And it's, we've been very successful at that and turning that into a business. You see that globally. The old world that was established on old ways of 1,000, 2,000 years ago, they were a little late to that party, and we've been very good at that. You know, there's a good side to that where you have a lot of very drinkable, nice wines at $10 and $12 a bottle that maybe you didn't have 50 years ago. The other side of that is a lot of stuff is, you know, I love sayings, and one of my favorite sayings is nobody writes poems about milk. And there are a lot of mundane wines, and some of them are really, really expensive, but that's how you, you know, if last year you made 600 cases of something for a few different distributors out of state, and this year they're all expecting a 20% growth, so 720 cases, you end up, stuff that wouldn't have gone into the blend before starts going inside into it. And so for me, you know, I didn't know any better. I was raised Mormon and that, and I got into it, and I happened to be lucky enough to work for a lot of great people that had kind of the old way. And my way is, once you get over that and kind of stop looking at that and you get in a certain flow, it's very easy to live that way. And, you know, it's not glorious, but, you know, wine's a reflection not only of the grape variety and the nature, but it's also very much a reflection of people and the people that farm it and the people that make it into wine. And that's part of it as well.
One of the other winemakers told me a number of years ago that you were going for a certain standard. And while things change every year in terms of how a particular varietal may come across in a bottle up the road, when people are used to a certain standard of quality, I mean, your name's on it. And if that means, you know, you need to sell the grapes to somebody else who's less concerned about that or whatever, he said there's times you got to do that if you're going to have a long-term credibility as a fine wine maker.
Yeah, for sure. Not only as a winery, but as a region. And to be honest with you, that's what gives pricing power to places like New Zealand and Napa Valley historically, is that you might be out of state in a restaurant, and you pick up the list and you look and it says Napa Valley, and you're going, well, I don't know that winery, but okay, I know Napa produces nice stuff. As soon as you start mixing it up and, you know, that area produces $9 wine and $400 wine, and some of it's not very interesting, yeah, you do get that. So I'd also argue it's good business. So the thing is that the people that tend to just bottle what they make, you know, it's fine. Sometimes it's more of a tasting room location. There are certain tasting rooms that are more like special event center that people just want a glass of wine, like going into a pizza parlor and having house wine. People that really pursue fine wine, it gives you pricing power. And it gives you the ability, if you consistently do a quality product, not only locally, but when you go to pour wine, you know, outside of our area, you work with the trade as well as the consumer, and that gives you the ability to charge a premium price because people are willing to pay for something that's very, very nice. A dear friend of ours who's been in the Valley for a long time and is kind of a local celeb, we were talking about that last night, that, you know, he used to go and like shop hard, you know, wines at discount centers, and I did the same thing when I got into wine and that, you know, really go through them and that, and it's like we both have the luxury now to like go taste things and know consistent producers and exciting producers and to go purchase those, and you know that's part of the I guess the richness of becoming older.
Well, and you know, I try a lot of different, you know, I'm still trying to learn a lot of things, and I try things from different regions and different countries. I've been you know, checking out a lot of Italian wines and Austrian wines, mm-hmm. lately, and you know, every place has their own component. Even there's some folks with organic grapes. There's a little bit of a different feel to what I've tasted anyway in some of those, and at various price points. And it's just, it's kind of a fun, you know, for me, it's just been like a fun learning experience of the last you know, 15, 16 years, because I started out with, you know, at that point, I didn't drink wine.
Yeah. It's really a beautiful thing. And it's a little, wine is a little bit of a passport if you're into it. I mean, there's so many different places. And like I said, it's not only, you know, the soil and the climate, the grape variety, but it also is the culture and what the culture eats and how they eat and who they eat it with. All those things are manifest in that. You know, it's endless. I mean, if you look at a lot of the great minds of history, Thomas Jefferson, Pliny the Elder, these people were fascinated by fine wine and wrote about fine wine, collected fine wine because of these differences. So maybe the most direct connection we have to nature in terms of a food product is wine. And I mean, you can go back to, you know, Roman times and pre-Roman times and people talk about vintage in some of the writings, and that they talk about vintages of things that are grown like on the side of Mount Vesuvius and this. And so it's something that's very unique about wine. So you see it, the great food products of the world always speak to where they come from. So we have San Francisco sourdough bread that we're all very familiar with, and that there's, you know, breast chicken from France. There's Nagano chicken in Japan that are not what we would even almost consider chicken. They're super unique, beautiful food products that are very unique to a place. True Wagyu beef kind of thing. Same thing is true with wine, and wine is actually much more sensitive. So if you look at most fruits in the world will have maybe 100, 200 chemicals that could potentially give them their flavor that are in other forms of nature, but there's always one that's dominant. So like the flavor of a banana is called isoamyl acetate. And so bananas around the world have isoamyl acetate. It doesn't matter where you grow them. Some places are a little bit sweeter or less acidity in that. And so we say, oh, that's special in this area. Wine grapes, the average wine grape has about 400 different flavor compounds to give other fruits and vegetables and herbs their flavor, and there's no one dominant. So, you know, you go into a magic shop, they have these boards with the metal pins on it. You take your hand, you push it up, or you take your fist and push it up, and you'll see the print of what you're pushing up into it. Those pins above will rise up. That's what a wine grape does. A wine grape really measures that sight, and so it's the flavors and the fingerprint, and that's how somebody that's been taught to read, basically, in the case of wine, if it's a wine that's a wine of places, I say, where you can actually smell and taste it, and it fingerprints it. You can tell it's from an area that's cooler, that maybe sees not as sunny a days, or more kind of like scud cloud days, we say, where you have overcast and that, a little bit warmer, whatever. It'll smell and tell you that, smell and taste in a way that will tell you that story, and that's absolutely fascinating.
Dyson DeMar from Hillcrest Vineyards, Paul O'Brien Winery, and Pasa Colina. More when we come back. The interview, a podcast after one at 541radio.com, 1248 at News Radio, 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN. Inside Douglas County, 1249, Lars Larson at 1, Umpqua Valley Live at 4, looking at arts, entertainment, community activities, Dyson DeMara, Hillcrest Vineyards, Paul O'Brien Winery, and Pasa Colina in this afternoon, covering a lot of things, and as is typical with a conversation with you, we're not going to get through all the questions. So, great opportunity to learn. I'm curious about what happens this time of year. Now, you said you just got everything kind of situated. What happens in the, you know, November, December for a local wine grower?
We go to the south of France. No. It's a time to kind of rest up a little bit. There's a calendar that's very consistent. You know, I think the Burgundian monks wrote this calendar up. It's an illustrated calendar of what you do every month of the year if you grow grapes and make wine. And this is the time we actually get a little bit of a breather post-harvest in that. We just put stuff away in that, and usually until the first of the year we're, you know, maybe doing small projects and that around. If you're in the trade in terms of distribution, you're out working the marketplace at pre-holiday to place wines, get wines through the system and that. But this is a breather point for us. After the first year, we'll start pruning. And then it's kind of every month you go in and out and out, from racking to fermentation to bottling, all these different things, that you, and pruning outside, spraying. It's like a month crack at a time, pretty much.
Coming out of COVID, or whatever we want to call this current phase of life, did you see wine tourism up locally?
Yeah, I know this year was, I'd say it was slightly down, and this is general consensus in the area. It picked up a little bit late in the season and ended up finishing off pretty strong as a good year, but it was kind of a little bit off. We had a lot of support, a lot of local support, and even support from outside the area during the shutdown. As many of you know, we were open for sales and that, not so much tasting in the beginning, but then later on tasting. And so I think we're hopefully moving back to a little bit of norm based on what that situation was. So I kind of feel like here in the last couple of months, we're just kind of in that groove again, and you know, hopefully that continues on for the next 40.
So we've got this thing called Thanksgiving next week, apparently.
Yeah.
And that elicits these big family meals and all of that, and results in my house of like a meal and a half, because there's things my wife and daughter want that I'm not eating. And so it's been real interesting. But people oftentimes want to celebrate, want to have wine, even if they're not a normal wine drinker. What? How do you pick a wine for the holidays?
So true. And Thanksgiving is, it's our favorite holiday of the year. We just feel so blessed to have the family that we do and live where we do and be able to live our dream. But it's, you know, a lot of people consider the Thanksgiving table a challenge. I think it's really, really beautiful. There are so many different flavors and textures. And we've talked about this before, where you have something, you know, acidic and sweet like cranberry sauce alongside stuffing that's, you know, rich and earthy cooked inside the bird, versus turkey that can be sometimes a little bit neutral in that. So having something that is very, very fruit driven, that has beautiful acidity, typically no tannin, no oak, both, you know, not that whites, no, some whites have tannin, very few, but some, both white and red. It's an incredible opportunity to open quite a few bottles like with a tasting group almost, where you have different bottles and you get to taste different things. It's a great opportunity to be able to taste out of several different bottles. Also, I look for low alcohol wines. It's nice to actually have glasses on the front end of dinner and the back end of dinner and with dinner kind of thing. And alcohol is something, you know, probably we don't have the time now, but it's absolutely fascinating. You know, there's a logarithmic difference in terms of how your body reacts to like 11.5% alcohol versus like 12.5, 13. We just think, oh, it's a little bit more. It's radically different. I would say, and you touched on something that's super important, I rarely hear anybody talk about, and that's that at that table, not only do you have all these crazy flavors and textures that you were trying to match, but you have people that don't drink wine, people that would be open to drinking wine, never had one they liked, people, Uncle Bob that knows everything about wine, bores everybody to death. And we all need a drink for that. So the thing is that there are certain flavors and ranges of flavors that you can present that almost everybody likes. I do every year, the wines that we share at our table, I do a selection, and there's usually one Hillcrest in there too, and then some other things. And so we sell that as a special discounted pack. But like this year's two Beaujolais. So Beaujolais is something you go to Burgundy, France, where Pinot Noir is very famous. What the winemakers drink there every day is Beaujolais from a grape called Gamay that we just started making from the old Tessoaria property that we took over here about a year ago. I've got great Muscat from the most famous vineyard in the world, which is Italy. So Muscat is called Muscat Canelli. It's from the Canelli Vineyard in Piemonte, northern Italy, that we have a little relationship there. We do this little piggy Barbera. Barbera is the same kind of thing. Go to northern Italy. The producers make these really expensive Barolos, Barbarescos, but they drink a lot of what's called Barbera. And it has no tannin and has beautiful, beautiful fruit, nice acidity. So we have a range of flavors. And so it's an interesting time. I'd also say Riesling, great Riesling that's kind of off dry or totally dry. And we produce wines in Germany and that. Those are the super interesting wines. If you want to have something more than just like, oh, here's some wine and everybody drinks wine, talks about something else, wines to kind of put out there in the table and kind of rock everybody's world, where wine becomes part of the conversation or what is that? This is an incredible opportunity. And if anybody wants to, we're the tasting room, of course. We're open every day up until Thanksgiving. We would love to have you come out. We can talk about different flavors. Or if you're having something unusual, you're having barbecued ribs too, I do that. I've got wines for that. But the thing is that it's a time you want to stay away from what we consider oftentimes to be classic wines, oaky, tannic, structured wines. You want wines that are fruit-driven with really, really nice acidity to tie things together and to stand up to the bold flavors.
Wow. Boy, some great ideas there. And it's amazing the differences. We've only got a minute left, of having a glass of wine and having it with food.
Totally. The French have a saying, wine is a eunuch without food. And I mean, my wife and I were in 2014 were in India, and for 2 weeks we had lunch and dinner every day without wine, and the food was very different than what we experienced once we left country. Wine is acidic. So all of those you like to cook in that, and some a dish is missing something, one of the tricks of the kitchen, professional kitchens, is acid and squeezing a lemon at it to pop flavors. Wine does that. Wine's an acidic beverage that opens up the flavors so you can taste more of the flavors, but it also releases those flavors from the food. And so, you know, once you get used to that, it's kind of a hard thing. Wine with, you know, water and milk, our dinner with water and milk is kind of, I don't know.
Yeah, that a lot of challenges coming up and an interesting time in the local wine industry. And look at that, we are already out of time, even though we're not out of questions. So we'll do this again. Dyson DeMar, thanks for coming in.
Always a great pleasure. Thank you, Colin. Happy Thanksgiving to everyone.
1257 News Radio, 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Listening to Inside Douglas County on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN, a daily look at the people and issues that are shaping Douglas County. It's presented by Concrete Builder Supply. The show will be available as a podcast in just a few minutes at 541radio.com. So share it around and let others who weren't listening live know about today's show. Inside Douglas County is a public affairs presentation of Brook Communications. Stay connected with local news and information. News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.